Thank you for choosing this ABC Radio National podcast. When it's finished, we'll have details on other informative and entertaining programs you may be interested in. But right now, here's your podcast.
Hello, Richard Ada here with Life Matters on ABC Radio National. Hope you can stay with me over the next hour. Got something different for you today, something special. Australia has a 21st century economy with a 19th century education system. That's Rupert Murdoch's damning assessment in his Boyer Lectures, currently being broadcast on ABC Radio National. But is it fair? Today, a forum recorded earlier this week on what a 21st century education might actually look like, with some of the top education reformers and innovators in the world. Let me introduce the panel. Barry McGaw holds one of the key jobs in the country. He was appointed by the Prime Minister earlier this year to lead the National Curriculum Board, which will change what is taught in our schools. No easy task. He's also director of the Melbourne Education Research Institute and former director of education at the OECD. Until a couple of months ago, Chris Wardlaw, an Australian, was an education reformer in Hong Kong, now a top-performing country in those international league tables. He was the Deputy Secretary for Education, a position he held for 6 years. Chris has another career too. He was head coach of the Australian track and field team at the 2000 Olympic Games, and he remains a keen distance runner. I'm sure that persistence and stamina must help in the task of modernising education. From the United Kingdom, two guests, Valerie Hannon is Director of Strategy for the Innovation Unit. We'll find out more about that soon. And she's a former Director of Education for Derby County. Valerie is interested in how to get innovation into education. And our fourth guest, Michael Stevenson, is especially interested in technology and education. He's Vice President of Global Education at the technology firm Cisco Systems. He's a former Director of Technology at the Department of Education and Skills in England. And before that, he was a broadcaster and manager with the BBC. So, what about Rupert Murdoch's assessment? Let's begin with Barry McGaw.
There are elements of truth which make it credible, but I don't think it's basically right. The Australian education system in the international comparisons performs very well at the school level. We're amongst the top performing countries by the measures we used at the OECD. The one thing where we do stand out, though, as relatively weak, and to which he did refer, is the relatively high proportion of our young people who don't finish secondary school or its equivalent. That's one of the points he made, and he's absolutely right to say that. We said in the mid-80s that we would have 90% completion rates by the end of the 80s, by 1990. We never got past 80%, and we're now setting 90% as our new target, forgetting we did that 25 years ago. If you look at 24-year-olds and compare the unemployment rates of those who finished upper secondary school or its equivalent and those who did not, the rate for those who didn't is almost 2.5 times the rate for those who did in Australia. And there's only one country in the OECD with a higher ratio, and only just higher than ours. So you'd say, you would expect that the disadvantage of not finishing would be great when almost everybody finishes and only a small minority didn't. Australia's in 20th position near enough in the OECD, so we've got a large proportion, relatively speaking, who don't finish, and yet they are at a bigger disadvantage than their counterparts in virtually every other country. So it really does matter in Australia.
And it's different for girls and boys, isn't it?
Girls do better than boys in education in every respect. They perform better, they're more likely to complete upper secondary education, they're more likely to go to university, they're more likely to graduate in minimum time.
Chris Wardlaw, you're fresh from Hong Kong. What would a 21st century education system look like? How is it different from what we have now?
21st century learning. Basically, it's about developing lifelong capacities in our young people. And we can define those fairly specifically in a range of ways. First of all, it's obvious things like domain expertise. We need to have good scientists and mathematicians and economists and so forth, and we'll continue to need that. But they'll be independent thinkers. They'll have more self-direction and self-managing of their own learning. They'll be very good users of IT and ICT. I think the things that we're starting to see that are really becoming more critical as we've got such an interconnected world is the inter and intrapersonal skills of young people are becoming more and more paramount. And their sense of identity, I mean, we had the discussion about history and so forth, but it's really about identity and responsibility and a sense of ethical behaviour. So the system really has to, what we're working on are system influences on creating those sorts of young people. Easy to say, very hard to do.
Valerie Hannon, some of those things that Chris was just saying, they'll strike a chord. These are what we are beginning to think more of as 21st century skills. Can you expand the list for us?
Yes, they are absolutely universal, I think, preoccupations of education systems across the globe. If I were to expand on them, I suppose I would add a real emphasis on creativity, not least because in most developed economies now, the creative economy is no longer kind of additional nice to have, but is a multi-billion dollar industries which young people desperately are keen to join, and for very good reason. And they know that different skill sets are needed to achieve and do well in those industries. That's one thing. I think our notions of what it means to collaborate have been transformed by the possibilities of new technologies, where young people now take social networking and building their learning products in virtual spaces for granted in ways that we, latecomers to those virtual worlds, can hardly conceive. And so their abilities to collaborate and build new learning spaces are phenomenal and extremely interesting.
I have to ask about your job. You're at the Innovation Unit.
Yep.
What is the Innovation Unit?
The Innovation Unit is a small, not-for-profit agency which is dedicated to supporting teacher practitioners to innovate in teaching and learning.
Michael Stevenson, if I come to you, are your children getting a very different education from the one you had?
I think they're getting a better education than the one that I had. They're taught in great schools, as it happens in South London. They have inspirational teachers. And the older one, Tom, who's 17, happens to be studying the International Baccalaureate. So whereas I studied in the late 70s, a very narrow field happened to be the classical world, Latin, Greek, and ancient history. He's studying a broad mix of humanities and sciences. But here's what I'd say. I don't think the nature of the education he's getting is different in kind from the one I got 30 years ago. I don't think he's learning necessarily to work in teams across interdisciplinary boundaries, solving complex problems. I think he's mastering a body of knowledge and fact in much the way that I did. And I regret that because I think he will need some of those new skills for a new century.
You're interested in technology and you're at Cisco, so that's natural. But why is Cisco interested in education?
Well, a couple of reasons, I suppose. One is we employ not far short of 70,000 people in 160 countries. And we'd like to feel that the young people we bring into the organisation have got the skills to thrive and to help this company forward. The jobs are demanding, a lot of fun, I think, but not anyone can do them. The second reason is that we think we've something to offer. Cisco, yes, it's a networking company, but above all, it helps people who have to solve great system problems. They could be in the health service, they could be in retail or banking, and in this case, in education. And we think that we have some sort of grasp of what it takes to crack big, complex system problems, sometimes driven forward by digital networks. So that, I think, those two things is what we feel we bring.
If the teaching is good, and teaching, I think, and we'll get to more of this later, teaching is obviously critical, and the curriculum is sound, how much does technology really matter?
Well, if the skills that we want our young people to acquire are around communication, around working together, around creativity, to pick up some of the things that Chris and Valerie talked about, then it makes real sense, doesn't it, that the new generation of technologies, the so-called collaborative technologies, which are about collaboration and creativity and communication, should come, perhaps for the first time, right into the heart of the teaching and learning process. That's the simple logic that says technology's time has come.
I was reading your paper earlier, and there's a very disconcerting chart on it, which looks at how exposed, I think it's 17-year-olds in Holland are to networking technologies. And if you look at their day, the only time they're not really exposed to those things is when they're at school. So at every other time, they're kind of bathed in a connected environment, but at school, we're still not really using those technologies.
That's right. And that chart isn't saying that we ought to give carte blanche to every child to fiddle with their mobile phone all the way through physics. That's not what we're saying. What we're saying is that there is now a generation of technologies that could sit on the network at a learner's laptop and could really drive forward the new kind of teaching and learning we want to see. And it's a real shame that in far too many countries and in far too many schools, that has scarcely been considered yet.
Barry, I want to come back to you because I've touched on curriculum and you're leading curriculum change in Australia. We know there's differences between state and territories. I think we have 8 different curricula at the moment. But why does curriculum need reform?
And frankly, I think the reason that there's such an appetite at the moment is this. We are in a globalised world now where we tend as Australians to make comparisons not across our within country borders, but across the seas to other countries. We think nationally about ourselves in an international context, and we do that in a whole range of areas. And increasingly, we're doing it in education. The reason for a national curriculum is partly based on concerns about 80,000 students who cross state boundaries each year, but that's not the main reason, in my view. The main reason is that we're increasingly willing, as a country to say, a country of just over 20 million people, to say what it is we want young Australians to understand, know and be able to do. We don't want to answer that question differently in Brisbane from Melbourne or in Perth from Sydney. We have a sense that we are one and we ought to be thinking nationally about what schools should be doing for our children.
Where are we on the journey, if you like? When will the changes actually kick in?
The National Curriculum Board's initial responsibility is only for English, mathematics, the sciences and history. We have a remit to look subsequently at geography and languages other than English, but the first four were to be completed by 2010. So from 2011, the national curriculum will be available. It won't be implemented fully and everywhere in 2011. If you think about Year 11 and 12, for example, you've got to give students fair warning of a change from a current arrangement because they're preparing for examinations and so on, and all states have rules about that need to be respected. There'll be some phasing for that reason, and there'll be phasing at the upper school for the reason of notice, but from 2011.
Many parents, and employers too for that matter, are concerned about the basics. I think they're talking about the basics of when they went to school, certainly when I went to school. So spelling and punctuation, other measures of literacy and numeracy, times tables are very popular with some people. Are they still going to be at the core of learning in primary school?
Well, some people would say, are they going to be again at the core rather than will they still be at the core? But what we've done as a first step, and it's turned out to be quite helpful, actually, instead of getting immediately into the detailed curriculum development, we have produced documents that are no more than 20 pages, one for each of the areas, that says, here's what history should look like, kindergarten through year 12. Here's what math should look like, kindergarten through year 12, and so on. And we've got those out, we've had those out for consultation in national forums. Revised versions will go on our website for comment and advice to the end of February next year from anyone who wants to give us advice on them. And it's quite interesting to see what's in there. In the maths one, for example, it says there are some things that it is good to be able to do quickly and automatically. So the maths curriculum will talk about what maths you should be able to do without the aid of any kind of electronic device. But it will also say what maths you should do with really good electronic devices, because there are certain maths you can only do with such really good electronic devices. So it'll strike that kind of balance. In the English proposal that's now before us, instead of, as most people in the past have done, I think, to say, well, English is about literacy and literature, said English is about language, literature, and literacy. Now, language is about the nature of the language, the grammar of the language, the way you write in the language. Literature is about reading pieces of work in the language. And then literacy is about using the language in quite applied circumstances. And some of those are technical writing circumstances, others are creative writing circumstances. But by making that distinction, by putting language in that way, there is going to be an emphasis upon students understanding the structure of the language, the grammar of the language. We'll give them a language to talk about grammar. I find lots of people, including English teachers, don't have a language to talk about grammar these days.
On Life Matters on ABC Radio National, we're actually coming to you today from the National Curriculum Conference in Curriculum Corporation Conference in Melbourne, and we're at a special forum. My guests are Professor Barry McCaw, who's head of the Curriculum Board in Australia, Valerie Hannon, who's director of the Innovation Unit in the UK, Michael Stevenson, Vice President of Global Education at Cisco, and Chris Wardlaw, who's former Deputy Secretary for Education in Hong Kong. He just finished up there in September. Chris, what about the basics in Hong Kong? Do they still matter?
Of course, and imagine me saying they don't. Of course they matter, but as Barry mentioned, I think in Hong Kong, and not only in Hong Kong, you know, across the globe, the debates are very much the same. You know, there's the geography wars and there's phonics versus whole language and so forth. I like to think about it as and rather than or, because I think we create these dichotomies which are wonderful for headlines and the media, but they don't actually make much sense on the ground professionally. What Hong Kong has done has been terribly pragmatic. We looked at what students' future lives might look like. We tried to think about those capabilities, which are generally, you know, they're not any different in Hong Kong than in Australia, largely. But we wanted to treasure what the existing strengths of the system, and they have a wonderful strength in early years in mathematics and language. So we're not going to we're going to make sure we keep those strengths, but also look outward. Hong Kong's a very outward-looking city, looks north and looks east and west, and it wants to be right at the leading edge. So it benchmarked vigorously. I actually think there's an international curriculum in a lot of areas. That may be a little bit simplistic, but I certainly think in mathematics there's a lot of commonality across the globe. In economics, I often joke that opportunity cost is the same in Beijing as it is in New York, as it is in Central Africa.
It is a transformed system, though, isn't it? Away from that, what was essentially a British system of a time, to something that is more distinctly and determinedly kind of global in its outlook.
Yeah, absolutely. It had inherited a UK system, but it hadn't progressed as much as the UK. A classic case of a new society not having grown. The education system hadn't grown. So there was a deliberate effort post-handover to modernise and to change the curriculum. So in a lot of ways it had some big advantages, that there was a sense of urgency and a need to modernise. But I would have to say it hasn't changed. It is changing. And essentially we're set in progress a reform that began, the consultation began in 1998. The big ideas were set out in 2000, and the first graduates of the system, university graduates, because we're changing university education as well, finish in 2016. It was resourced, timetabled, so we'll really only know the impact in about 2020, which is fortunate for a bureaucrat like me, because I'll be back here. But certainly we believe that what we've put in progress there will have long-term benefits for students.
Just briefly, it's different now to what we think of as the education, the school system here, in that I think there's 3 years of kindergarten effectively. Fewer go to year 12.
Yes.
What else is different?
Many fewer go to year 12 at the moment, but the big change is we jumped to about 95% in 2012, and that's precisely the work we've been doing. So we've done a quantum jump in participation, but we've got to do the curriculum that engages the kids, and so there's a range of changes. But I think the biggest single idea that's important is that they've looked at as a K to 16 approach. So they're look very closely at the interfaces into the early years, into primary, into junior secondary, senior secondary, and then into university. So the university change is massive. We're going from 3 years to 4 years. And that's part of the intersectoral reform to open up the whole school curriculum, because often university will drive what happens. So it's a comprehensive approach. It's not just a curriculum approach, but curriculum's at the heart of it.
It's got to go to culture.
And yes and no.
Well?
Yes and no.
What about the status of teachers? What's that like?
Our status of teachers is not... teachers would say it's not what it was. It's reasonable, you know, Confucian culture sort of respects the teacher, but many teachers would say we're not respected like we were 20 years ago. They've had popular culture like we've had popular culture. So teachers, we would think that the attention to the profession hasn't been what it should be, just like I think Australian people would say. So the cultural issues, I don't like to say the culture is so dramatically different in Asia, therefore it's not relevant to us. The culture of high expectations can be made very explicit. And it can be done in any society. Focusing students on better learning is not specific to Asian students or Australian students or Indian students. It can actually be done with quite explicit behaviours.
From what you've all been saying, core literacy and numeracy still really matter, but there's a whole new set of skills students have to develop. Well, that's got to be a challenge for teachers. Now, Barry, I know that you're not 100% convinced that these skills are that new.
Well, I'd say two things. In reducing it to those two, you left out a third, which we won't lose in our curriculum, and that is explicit, deep understandings and knowledge in specific domains. There is knowledge to be acquired, understandings to be gained, skills to be developed in science. The same in history. And that'll be central to our curriculum as well. In addition, we'll have these more generic skills or general capabilities, as they're sometimes called. I think they're important. I don't disagree with anything that's been said. The point that I would make is that some of these have been specified for a while now. We talked about key competencies here in the 1980s and again in the 90s with the Mayer Committee and again in 2002 with the Business Council and the Chamber of Commerce and Industries document on employability skills. So they've been around. They are important. But they are not the only things. No one's going to hire an engineer who can simply work with others if they can't do the engineering.
Because I could do that. I could do the working with others. It's the engineering I would struggle with. Anyone who follows education will hear for some years now the astonishing performance of Finland, in particular in terms of these international PISA assessments of how well students are going, not only in terms of achievement, in terms of equity too. Valerie, everybody wants to emulate Finland, but Finland has a much more homogenous culture and probably doesn't have the big differences between people who are well off and not so well off that we see both here in Australia and the UK and America, for example. It's not that easy to just take it and bring it elsewhere, is it?
Absolutely not. And Chris was saying earlier the importance that we have to attach to context without being completely enslaved by it and thinking that context is all. But to understand the Finnish experience, I think the factors that you just touched on there are immensely important, as indeed are things like the structure of their language and the degrees in which that makes it a much easier language to learn to read and to write.
Very difficult language to learn if you're not Finnish.
Well, that's a different matter. But, so those contextual factors are critical. But what interests me about Finland is that far from being a country which thinks they've cracked it and become the market leaders in the education marketplace, they are deeply self-critical. And as a nation which has prospered as a result of its capacity to be innovative, is now setting out a direction of travel which says we can't stop here. Our notion of what counts as good teaching and good learning has to change very much along the lines that Michael set out for Cisco in the white paper and Barry and others have been talking about. Thinking again about what are the skills that young people need, thinking again about the way in which we organise learning and design it to achieve those. So we're going to see a lot of changes in Finnish education and we want to be alongside that and leapfrogging it if possible.
One of the ways in which Finland doesn't seem innovative but seems deeply old-fashioned is the status mm-hmm. of teachers, mm-hmm. the regard people have for teachers. Mm-hmm. Teachers are not actually highly paid, particularly in Finland. They would say they're not. But they all have master's degrees. Mm-hmm. That is something that we can try to emulate. Should we try?
Well, I don't think we should. I'm not sure I agree with you on the salary question either. I think they are quite well paid. And by master's degree, what do we mean? I mean, you know, there's master's degrees and master's degrees. So I think you have to dig deep to understand those comparisons. But no, I don't think we should try. I mean, I come back to what Chris was saying about the shift in terms of how teachers across different cultures are regarded. And I don't think, certainly in the UK, I can't speak about Australia, I don't think we're ever going to return to a kind of goodbye Mr. Chips type, you know, sir with his mortarboard and headmasters in high levels of authority. I don't think you go back in time. Those days are gone. And I think that the profession in our contexts and in our cultures is going to start to acquire respect from a different point of view as people who are deeply professional in the sense of very high levels of expertise, very high levels of commitment to their young people, and that is recognised by those young people and their families, but more as folk who work with families rather than who are looked up to as authority figures. I think those days are gone.
You wanted to come in, Barry?
Well, just on the question of Finland and whether it's a reasonable comparison, I make two points. One is there are some things we can learn from them, the stuff about the teaching professions, one, but another interesting piece of evidence about Finland is that if you look at where systems invest additional resources in students who are struggling, what you find is that Finland alone, among the OECD countries for which we had data on this, invests more in the first year of school than in later years of school, whereas most systems invest more towards the end of primary, by which the times the problems students are having are more manifest but are also more intractable. So the early intervention, I think, is an important feature of Finland's program. But if you wanted to dismiss Finland, as people might want to, on the grounds that it's more homogeneous, it's smaller, it's got two languages, by the way. There's a quite substantial Swedish-speaking community, and everybody has to learn both languages at school, which would stretch them a bit beyond the way we stretch our students. The other point of comparison that's of interest is Canada. Canada performs well, like we do, sometimes better than us in the international comparisons. But in Canada, as in Finland, differences in students' social backgrounds matter less than in Australia. So I think what we ought to be aiming to be is high quality and high equity, like Canada.
Your point about the upfront investment early on is a very, very interesting one, in a context where children start school much, much later. At seven. Whereas in the UK, that would be thought to be dereliction of duty almost. But of course, that's based on a ubiquity of childcare, a very, very high quality childcare, and an expectation of parental involvement, high levels of parental leave, for example, and engagement of parents in the learning journey. So again, you know, you can't dissociate it from the social structure and the expectations of what society will invest.
I'll come to parents in a moment, but just while I've got you, Valerie. You visit many schools. When you do, I mean, they look pretty much the same, most of them, as they did 50 years ago. Desks lined up, teacher out the front. How resistant are schools to innovation?
Well, I'm with Barry on this. I disagree with you that all schools do look like that. And
we're going to fall out because we can't seem to agree on anything.
No, OK, well, that's healthy. In England, in the last 5 years, there has been a huge investment, I mean, multi-billion pound investment in building schools for the future. And if you were to go into many of those environments, you would not find the picture that you're looking at there at all. I'm not saying it's disappeared altogether, but it's a changing picture, no question. And the spaces are different, and the forms of teaching that go alongside that are different too. I think one of the striking differences is now the penetration of really high-quality information communication technology. It's not unusual. It's not common, but it's not all that unusual to go into schools where every child has a laptop and they take that with them, where they're working with a school-created virtual learning environment which they can access at any time, day or night, and their parents can too. So those parents know what the learning program is, what the goals are for that particular module of the curriculum, where their kid is in terms of their own achievement on that learning journey, and a back and forth between the teacher and parent and child about the child's progress. I think you would agree that's not exactly what we found in the 19th century.
Not at all. Chris, in Hong Kong, you're working, you've been working on ways to get parents more involved, and this is bearing in mind where the parent culture is about high expectations. Mm. How are you getting them more involved?
Well, we had reading as a priority task, which is a good example. There's been a whole community effort in a sense that education is considered important by nearly everyone in the community. There's no discussion when there are huge investments in funding every budget since 1997. No one demurs. Everybody says, yes, spend more on that. The whole community engagement, because they do value education, it's a classic meritocracy. They believe that education is the one way to get through. Wealth can't buy you a place in any school. There's no secular debate. All schools are funded by the government, except for a very small proportion of international schools. Again, it's this context which is terribly important. And another thing that came up with the Finland discussion is Hong Kong students start later as well. Mm. Primary's at 6. And they have about 95% participation in 3 years of kindergarten and longer time in kindergarten. So parents support their children in that extra time on education through homework and so forth. So there's a lot of parental expectations which support the learning.
Michael Stevenson, Cisco's got partnerships in many countries of the world, but I'm thinking of, we've just been hearing about Hong Kong, other parts of China, India too, the coming economic powerhouses, China already is one. What's the situation there in terms of 21st century education?
Lots of people these days talk a very good game. You can wander into education ministries in almost any country you like and have a rich conversation about 21st century learning and the ambitions of policymakers show up in the schools, and it's a different matter altogether. So just to compare and contrast, I spent a little time with colleagues in India in the early summer and was read a terrific lecture in Delhi about just how fantastic the school reform program has been. And I was drowned in statistics that proved it. But to go into the schools just around the corner was very different indeed. And when I began to ask how the policymakers were actually working with the schools, it turned out that it was actually part J. Rupert Murdoch, a bit like the 1880s in the sense that the director of the school system in New Delhi said it took him 3 months to get a letter out to the school around the corner because it had to go through 8 layers of bureaucracy. Took another couple of months to come back. So that's not really the context in which radical 21st century learning occurs. In China, which we have all understood is the traditional home of rote learning, where nothing changes, but there are, and always have been, perhaps the highest parental aspirations, we are seeing a remarkable willingness to change and change fast. After the Sichuan earthquake just 5 or 6 months ago, Cisco put quite a lot of money into a rescue program. We have quickly moved beyond rebuilding the schools. That didn't take very long at all. Sometimes the schools have actually been built from scratch in that period. And now we're into a promising agenda around professional development, working with leaders to rethink school systems, and thinking anew about 21st century curriculum. So China, I think, is moving very, very fast.
Barry, I want to come back to Australia. Here, the majority do pretty well, but there's the worrying tail in the graph of a sizable number doing badly. How does innovation, curriculum change, delivering technology lift this group up?
The tail in Australia is a worry not so much because of its length as because of the overrepresentation of students from disadvantaged backgrounds. That's the characteristic of our tail that is different from that, say, in Canada or Finland or Korea or Hong Kong. Curriculum can only ever be part of the story, but one of the things curriculum can do is to set high expectations for all students. When we moved in Australia to school-based curriculum development in the 1970s, one of the things we did was to liberate middle-class teachers to go into working-class schools and set curricula for the kids that they would never have their own children do. they made assumptions about what was possible for these students, and they set lower expectations. And we've done the same with Indigenous children. And if you look at, listen to the Indigenous leaders now, Chris Sarah, Noel Pearson and others are making strong claims. And the whole of the Northern Cape of Queensland, the school system there, is setting the same expectations for the Indigenous students as for others, and then saying, what do we need to do to achieve those, and not what different set of expectations can we set. Now, setting the expectations is only part of the story. It's what else do you do to facilitate schools' pursuit of those expectations. Of course, depends upon resourcing arrangements, staffing arrangements, practices within the systems and within the schools that are beyond the curriculum. But the curriculum can play an important part.
I have a few other questions, but it occurs to me that it might be time for questions from the audience.
Linda Mitchell from Australian Technical College in Sunshine. I just want to not show off, but mention what I've done in the last little while with a student and just ask a question about that, given everything that I've heard this morning. I have a student, a few students who are apprentices part-time who are also doing, have just completed VC English. And the way I've taught them has been very little time in class because of their work commitments, but via text, email, any time of the day or night. And I'm thinking what's different here. The curriculum isn't that different, but there's something about the learning transaction, the transaction between teacher and student, that's radically changed from when I was at school. And I'm not hearing that talked about in quite that way, and I'm wondering what people think about that.
Well, Valerie, I think it sounds fine to me. The crucial question is, are the students learning? Is the curriculum clear for them and for you as their teacher? And it sounds as though it is. And that what's going on here is a creative mode of delivery. When we specify the national curriculum in Australia, we will be giving information about what it is students should be entitled to learn, not necessarily about precisely how it should be arranged and taught. For example, we're imagining that the maths curriculum for kindergarten to year two might be 3 pages long, so it won't set out the methods of teaching. It will be accessible. Some teachers will teach it in different ways. So I warm completely to what you just said.
A couple of months ago, Cisco opened a new school in Manhattan in partnership with the New York Department of Education. It's called the iSchool, and it's based on quite radical approaches to new teaching and learning. So they spent their first month on an interdisciplinary project trying to work out what kind of learners all of those learners were and how they learned best. And they spent the last month thinking about the impact of 9/11 on New York City in every aspect. The economy, how to use freed up land, the history of Manhattan and what happened to it, how much was destroyed. And though the first phase was teachers sharing a narrative from the front, they quickly cleared out of the way and left it to teams of learners to take it forward themselves, using rich digital media. Quite hard for some of the teachers. They sort of felt redundant. They wanted to muscle back into the process. But little by little, they've realized that what they're really doing is working alongside individual learners and helping them get the very, very best out of the project, working in the ways that they learn. So we've begun to see real examples of teachers changing fundamentally the way they do things and letting the learners get on with it, interfacing directly with new digital media. It's very, very exciting, and I guess the way of the future. Not the only way of the future, and not instead of traditional learning. That has to be a real foundation. But once you've mastered some of that, it's great to get on to these new forms of learning, I think.
It's a good question. Who's got the next one?
Thank you. David Gallagher, Victorian Curriculum and Assessment Authority. I'd be interested in comments on what role do you see with the community playing in teaching and learning in the 21st century?
The inside-outside school fences, you know, they're just collapsing. We've got a much broader, we might call, faculty to support students. The way we're organising the curriculum means that there's many, many more who can assist in the learning of students. So if we look at community in its very broadest sense, new technologies are changing things dramatically, whether teachers like it or not, they are. And there's no doubt, my daughter just whizzes around the computer like I just can't believe what she can do. And I just look, what did you do there? What did you do there? So I think that whole feel And they connect to the community before we even think about it. I'd just like to say there's a major international study called CITES, which is a study of international technology in education. And one of the things a lot of the survey work has shown, that teachers actually believe in the new technology, believe in ICT, know its power, it can visualise, simulate, represent, connect, collaborative, all those things. They know that. What they haven't got is that the confidence to use it and the lots of barriers that are put up to their use, so they don't see it in a seamless way. And that's where I think the partners like Cisco and everybody else can help that a lot. The seamlessness for the teacher is the critical issue. So community is learning anytime, anywhere, and whether we like it or not, the school is still important and will be central, but it's just one of the places where kids will learn.
Yes, thanks. I think it's a great question, because I think a redefined role for the community, or communities, which I'd like to come back to, is going to be one of the key drivers of change in the 21st century. The other is ICT, and we've touched on that. But alongside that, if you think about communities, I guess our old vision or assumptions about what community meant was the locality around the school itself, and particularly the parents who came to the school gates and maybe came inside the classroom. But I think we need to expand that greatly and multiply. First off, it's not just those who have a direct relationship with the school as parents, or even those at second hand perhaps who are employers in the locality, but also other kinds of professionals, artists, people running different kinds of enterprises who have different kinds of expertise, which might make learning much more real to learners, especially in the early years of secondary, and whose expertise, if properly choreographed by teachers, different sorts of skills, will massively enrich what learning can be. So that's one definition of community. And the other is the virtual community, which young people can access much more readily now. Whether that's in China or the UK or Australia, they are making connections with communities of which we know little. And they are communities of interest, which can be immensely powerful. And I think we're only just starting to glimpse how those kinds of communities might also be drivers of learning.
Barry.
And we also need to be realistic about what we expect of local communities, particularly if by that we mean the parents. Because many parents today are both working in very busy jobs, and the expectation of availability has to be realistic. So I'd be looking for clever ways to engage beyond families, not to exclude families, but to engage beyond families. If we engage only with families, if that's what community means, then we're more likely just to continue privileging the privileged.
Do we have another question?
Thank you. Bernie Lloyd from Kew High School. I've just got two fears, and I wonder if the panel share them. The first one, as a teacher of long standing, is that I worry about the increasing divergence between students' lived lives and the lives they often lead at school, and I wonder if that's shared. And the second one is, if the national curriculum requires imprimatur of politicians when it's finally put before us as a possibility, I'm worried about the general trend of people, when they're nervous about change, to resurrect the backward-looking fears for the future. What about the golden past? What can we take from that? And I just hope that the people who are at the leading edge of this movement realise how brave and bold we're going to need to be, because there will be an outcry and a concern about anything that looks new and courageous and exciting. But if it's not challenging and engaging and relevant, it'll be a lot of, you know, brouhaha and not much result. That's my worries.
I think that's a good point. Politicians do tend to split the difference, if you like, when it comes to what they think public opinion is. Does anyone want to take that question?
Well, of course, it is true that at some point the Council of Education Ministers, federal and state, are going to be expressing views about what we do in the national curriculum development. But we've been given no detailed writing instructions at all. No one political has said to us, this is what the curriculum should look like. We are in a process of extensive consultation about that. And I think we're being helped by having, as I indicated before, these broad documents, 20-odd pages, kindergarten to year 12, broad scope. That's provoked a quite interesting discussion about some creative proposals about the way in which we organise history, for example, or the way in which we should lighten maths and science.
Barry, can I just say something, though?
Mm.
18 months ago, when Ross Garnaut was commissioned to provide his big report into the economics of climate change and perhaps what we ought to do, that was held up as a big document that would very largely inform what the Labor government, if it won the election, would do. And as we got closer and closer to that being delivered, it became clearer and clearer that it was regarded as one input. Are you not at all concerned that you may be generating an input?
No, no, no. You see, you're a journalist and your job's to be cynical. I'm an educationist and my job's to be optimistic. And I reckon we're going to be able to do this. And for a start, our documents are much smaller than his at this point. And even when they're finished, they'll be much smaller. And the costs are going to be not as substantial. There will be real costs for teacher professional development. But that doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot more than we presently spend. It may mean spending some of the money we presently spend a whole lot differently. No, I'm congenitally and by profession an optimist.
What about the other part of Bernie's question, which was the difference between the lived lives of students and what they have at school? Michael?
We tend to think that the world we know is immutable. The schools we've seen for all these years could never go away. But if this autumn's taught us anything, as we've watched financial institutions around the world disappear, it must be that nothing is really immutable. What happens is that sometimes sectors, institutions, just get out of touch with the way the world is, and they suffer for it. So the question is, as you rightly say, you know, as young people become social networkers and live their lives through the medium of technology, for better or worse, could they in the end vote with their feet and just say these education institutions we have to go to every day do not address the way we are? I think it's harder if there's a statutory obligation to show up at school, which is what is the case, of course, for most youngsters. Where it could really show first, I guess, is in higher education or tertiary. Could it just become the case that students don't see it as a good use of their time to show up for traditional ways of learning? And might they think, and they could be wrong, but might they think that Wikipedia, Google, and peer-reviewed work is the way forward? So I think we don't have very long to adjust our educational institutions to really react to the way young people are. And I think it's just possible that change, if we don't get things right, might come really quite quickly when it comes.
Thank you. Heidi Bush, Catholic Education Tasmania. I'm just wondering if you see the innovation that we've heard about as something that essentially needs to be sold. In Tasmania in recent years, there was an attempt at quite innovative curriculum change which died a fairly quick death, due in part to community backlash from a perceived move away from the back to the basics approach that we've heard about. I'm just wondering how you see achieving this innovation in learning and also achieving broad-ranging community support for that.
Oh, getting community support and getting support from the commentary, it's going to be important. And we spent a lot of time thinking about how to do that during the week in which we had our first national forums on the framework documents in English, Maths, the Sciences and History. And those of you who followed that debate might remember that when we first announced that that was our strategy, that we were going to have these documents prepared, the debate focused on the individuals whom we chose to hold the pen. Stuart McIntyre in the case of history, Peter Freebody in the case of English being the two most frequently criticised. There wasn't much attention to the fact that in neither case, in none of the four in fact, did the pen holder work alone. They worked with a surrounding group, John Hurst, Tony Taylor and others worked with Stuart McIntyre. Peter Freebody worked with a group of literacy experts and a group of literature experts. But what happened in the week that we held the meetings and put the documents out for discussion was, for the most part, the conversation moved from an argument about the persons to an argument about the ideas. And if we win that discussion, as I think we began to do that week, we've got every chance of taking the community with us. But it is important that we do that. And we're helped by the fact that neither of these proposals was entirely radical in the sense of saying there's a whole lot of stuff we won't do. Their view was there's a whole lot of stuff we should do intelligently and with a light enough touch to leave room to do other important things, but that we won't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Valerie, you must have thought about making sure innovation gets buy-in in a wider sense.
The kind of innovation that intrigues and interests me and consumes my professional life is that which is created by and driven by the users and the practitioners working very much at the chalk face or the laptop face, if you like. That doesn't need selling. It's driven by people's passions and their desire to do better for young people.
I would like to thank our panel, Valerie Hannon, Director of the Innovation Unit in the United Kingdom, Professor Barry McCaw, who's leading curriculum change in Australia as head of the Curriculum Board, Michael Stevenson, Vice President of Global Education at Cisco Systems, and Chris Wardlaw, former Deputy Secretary for Education in Hong Kong. I'm Richard Adie, and thank you to our audience here at the National Curriculum Conference in Melbourne. And that forum on 21st century education will be available on the Life Matters website, abc.net.au/rn/lifematters.
The pub circuit turned Australian bands into the toughest live bands in the world.
All this month on Into the Music, we're on the wide open road.
We'd see a brawl every night.
It was cool. It was a good way to learn to play.
Dark, sweaty suburban back bars and tiny, stinky inner city pubs. That's the sound of Australian music.
Wide Open Road continues this Saturday afternoon after the news at 5 on Into the Music here on ABC Radio National.
Now time for more of your letters and calls and, well, the things that irritate you continue to flood into us, especially expressions. Here's one from Rebecca. I'm annoyed by the unnecessary use of actually and physically. People often say things like, he actually physically moved it, in case you thought he moved it with the power of his mind. This one's from Julie. I hate the way that, like most young people, repeat the like word like in their like sentences. It's like totally annoying, especially when one has to like try and like communicate with them. 3/4 of like the words in their sentences are like the word like. It's as if they like can't find the words to like express like what they want to like say because their brain is like moving too fast for them to like have time to like stop and like think. It's like so not good communication. It's like, I don't know, like totally weird and so like primary school. It's like a really poor reflection of the like standard of like Australian education system. Like, I think Julie has made her point there. This one's from Colin on phrases that annoy. Plan ahead. One can plan in no other direction. I agree with you, Colin. Prior warning. Forewarned. Almost unique. The most unique. Can I add to those, Colin? And this, you hear this on the news a lot. You hear something's going to happen in a week's time. No, it's going to happen in a week. You don't have to say a week's time. Anyway, that's just me. Irritating. This one's from Jenny. Something I find really irritating is ABC presenters who speak American words and pronunciation. For example, someone who shall remain nameless, she's put in brackets here, Mr. Adie, saying something along the lines of people being more easily irritated now than 5 years ago because they've gotten older. I may have said that, though it's plausibly deniable, I think. I also hate ABC newsreaders who say appreciate, negotiate, and nudity, and I instead of me. Grammatical mistakes are always annoying and far too common. Okay, I think we'll stop on the annoying things, the irritating things. One here from Kate about the slap. This is the discussion the other day about that novel with Kostas Tsourkas. I enjoyed listening to the interview on Monday, and was really interested to hear about reactions to breastfeeding a 3-year-old child. My first reaction was, it's fine by me, people should get over themselves. But after having a bit more of a think, I think that the reaction of our society to this is bigger than breastfeeding. It seems that at the moment in Australia, things that are biologically normal are taboo. Grey hair, reduced sexual function as people age, people that don't sleep as much or as well as other people, droopy boobs and bums, wrinkles, cellulite, normal bodies. Most of these have been discussed at one time or another on Life Matters, and all of them are not acceptable in society. There are surgical, behavioural and pharmacological cures for them all. I'm wondering how we got so far from accepting our normal biology and how we can get more connected with the way our bodies normally are. Interesting, interesting response. Thank you for that, Kate. Now, coming up after the news on ABC Radio National, it's The Book Show with Ramona, and Ramona joins us now.
Hello, Richard.
Hello.
Well, are we not allowed to say nudity? What are we supposed to say instead of nudity?
I'm not sure, actually.
Okay, I'd just like to get it right.
I know it comes up a lot people on The Book Show.
Oh, it does. We're going to have a little bit of nudity. Well, eroticism, really. The Tale of Genji, which was written 1,000 years ago by a woman. We're celebrating 1,000 years of the Tale of Genji, and there's a lot of love affairs, and especially at the beginning part of the tale.
When this was written too, this was a big deal for a woman to write this, wasn't it?
It was a bit of a big deal, although we've got the Pillar Book as well by Sei Shonagon, which was written a little bit before it as well. So they had the what would you call it? They had the jump on us.
They did have the jump. Join Ramona for 1,000 years of the Tale of Genji right after the news. Now, tomorrow on Life Matters, Friday Talk Back, and we're talking about the modern-day grandparent. They're younger at heart. They have to be because there are a lot of them doing full-time childcare. Give us a ring tomorrow, whether you're a grandparent or whether you need one in your life.
The Anglican Church is known for standing up to the papacy and preferring a communion or community of churches to the centralization of power in one man. Its diversity has embraced local culture, but it can cause conflict and disharmony.
When I come back to Sydney to visit, I would be accepted as a deacon, but not as a priest or a bishop.
What does it mean to be Anglican? Find out on The Spirit of Things. Download it from the Radio National website.